The Beat podcast is brought to you by Nutritia and is designed for healthcare professionals only.
Hello and welcome to the third part of our mini-series of podcasts on the topic of what are the options for uncontrolled seizures when drugs don't work. This series is brought to you by Nutritia Ketogenics and I'm Sue Wood, specialist dietitian at Matthews Friends Clinics. Today I'm joined by Dr. Anita Devlin and we will be discussing the alternative management options for drug-resistant epilepsy. Welcome, Anita.
Hello, Sue.
Now, Anita is consultant paediatric neurologist at the Great North Children's Hospital in Newcastle and associate clinical lecturer at Newcastle University. Anita leads the Regional Paediatric Complex Epilepsy Service, which includes the investigation, diagnosis and management of complex epilepsy, including vagal nerve stimulation, ketogenic diet therapy, as well as appropriate referral for surgical assessment. So, Anita, you're an extremely busy person, and thank you so much for joining us today and giving you some of your precious time.
It's an absolute pleasure. So thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be invited. Thank you, Sue.
You're welcome. So I'd just like to start by asking you, what are the alternative management options for drug-resistant epilepsy?
Well, I'd like to start by mentioning surgery for epilepsy. And the reason for that is it's the only curative treatment currently available for focal lesional drug-resistant epilepsy. So it's kind of at the top of the hierarchy. And then ketogenic diet or ketogenic dietary therapy, as we now like to call it, and vagal nerve stimulation do lead to worthwhile reductions of seizures in drug-resistant epilepsy in over half of the patients, but they rarely achieve complete seizure freedom. In terms of deep brain stimulation, which some people may have heard of, there isn't yet sufficient evidence as to the optimal site to stimulate the brain for epilepsy, and significantly more research is required before this can be routinely recommended as a treatment. So I wasn't going to dwell on that very much today.
So there are some other options, but just going back to the surgical side, you've mentioned that it's actually the only curative option. And although it's invasive, There are other considerations, aren't there? Not everybody is suitable for surgery. I wonder whether you might be able to just mention a little bit about the process of assessing and making sure somebody's suitable.
Well, that's a very, very complex process. And there are 1 to 3 day conferences that discuss that in their own right. So suffice to say that it is quite a detailed technical assessment. I mean, to talk about the outcomes, the long-term, so 5 years or more, outcomes from surgery can give seizure freedom rates of 60%. And when it's compared as a treatment in that group with continuing drug therapy, as it was in a nice randomized control trial in 2017, at 12 months, the freedom from seizures in the surgical group was 77%, compared with 7% in the medical therapy group. And that's a huge difference.
It is remarkable, isn't it?
And it is. And there were other benefits demonstrated in that trial on behaviour, quality of life, social adjustment and so on. So it's not just about the seizures. As we know about epilepsy, it's accompanied by lots of other comorbidities related to seizures, and these also improve. I think that some people might be, you know, put off, you know, epilepsy surgery, brain surgery. It's quite an intimidating thought, often, initially at least, for families. But it has really a very low mortality rate. I mean, less than 1%, and serious complications are rare when this process, this assessment process, is undertaken in experienced and well-trained hands. So actually, the risks are very low, even though on the face of it, it seems quite a big thing to do. And clearly, from what I've said, the costs, you know, for the individual are less in the long term as well. So you get a chance to reduce or stop medication. That reduces the exposure to potential side effects and interactions. It reduces emergency medication use and admissions to hospital and all of those things. But, you know, the economics of it, if you look at it from purely that perspective, also make complete sense. So for lots of reasons, it's a good approach. In terms of the, well, who are the candidates then, if this is such a good option? It's presumed initially that the sort of epilepsy that will be suitable is coming from a particular focus in the brain, a particular site or area. Most often, the candidates do have a target visible on the MRI scan, but that is not necessarily a condition for referral. So as long as you have a child who has seizures that look as if they're coming from one place, i.e. they have a focal presentation in their body, maybe the right side but not the left, or other focal features, and they have perhaps a brain wave recording, which is called an EEG, which suggests that it might be coming from one place, then those children should be referred for assessment.
Yes. So it is selective, isn't it? And that's why I suppose the outcomes again tend to be extremely, extremely good, but not necessarily for all. So maybe we can go on and talk a little bit about another possibility, which is vagal nerve stimulation. And maybe could you just briefly touch on what the pros and cons of vagal nerve stimulation might be for individuals?
Well, for those who might be listening who perhaps aren't familiar with vagal nerve stimulation, children are considered for this treatment when they failed at least two anti-seizure medications. So drug-resistant epilepsy by definition. And what it is it's a little generator that is implanted underneath the skin, usually on the left side of the chest, which then has a lead which goes up and attaches to the vagus nerve in the neck. And then it delivers current in cycles, which then goes up the vagus nerve and into the brain. And the amount of stimulation that you might need is individually tailored. How rapid the cycling is can be individually tailored. And about half of the patients will benefit from a 50% reduction in seizure frequency. So that's at least as good as any medication on the market. Now, what are the benefits? Well, why should we implant a vagal nerve stimulator, you might say? Well, you know, there are significant advantages. So unlike medication, you don't have to remember to take it every day.
Very good point.
There are no known interactions. You might reduce the number or doses of drugs that the individual is on, and along with the emergency medications and the admissions to hospital, which is a benefit. It delivers the treatment constantly, day and night. And unlike drugs, you don't tend to have a honeymoon period. So often when we start a new medication in drug-resistant epilepsy, you might have a 3 to 6 month period where things appear to improve. And then sadly, that improvement is lost again. And that happens repeatedly with different medications. Whereas with VNS, the effect seems to build gradually over time, and certainly builds over the first 12 months. So you don't get that honeymoon period. The other issue is that there is a magnet that comes with the VNS, and if you swipe, or a parent or carer swipes the magnet over the device in the chest, it'll give an extra stimulation at that time. And the benefit of that is that the extra stimulation may abort a seizure if the parent can tell that one is coming on. It might shorten the seizure, even if the seizure's already started. Or it may shorten the duration of the seizure itself, but also the recovery period. And up to a quarter of families find that that facility is extremely useful. In addition to that, of course, they've brought out new models, new tech. And the first version had a facility in it which detected fast heart rate.
Yes, I'd heard about that one. Yes, yeah.
And most seizures, probably about 80% of seizures, are associated with a fast heart rate. So that will enable the device to give a stimulation at the point where it detects a fast heart rate. And the yet more modern version enables you to do some scheduled programming. So rather than the family having to come back every 2 weeks in the early days to have it ramped up gradually, because you can't suddenly put it on maximum current when it first goes in, it has a schedule within the device which will turn it up gradually over time without hospital visits. And also, yeah, and also the facility to sort of give a different day and night program. So you know, technology is ever improving. There are also published benefits in terms of quality of life, mood and behaviour, alertness. And there's no link with this device increasing the risk of sudden unexpected death in epilepsy either.
Okay.
There's no such thing as a free lunch, Sue, as we all know.
No, I know. How long would it take to know whether it's actually working? Does it take a while to know what outcome you're going to get with vagal nerve stimulation?
Yeah, so that's very variable. And some children are fortunate enough to experience a benefit by 8 weeks. Sometimes the families report that, oh yes, we can tell a difference immediately. With others, it's a slower building pattern of progress. So the advice we give to families is we can't reach any conclusions about whether or not this is offering anything probably until 12 months. So stick with it. But there are cons. You know, you are asked about pros and cons, risks and benefits. And, you know, it's a surgical procedure. The surgical risk is small, but nonetheless, it is a surgical procedure that requires a general anaesthetic, and that can worry some families. Children, you've got the scar, of course, on the chest. And wherever you make a wound, there's a risk of infection. But in fact, that risk of infection is quite small. The average battery life for one of these devices is about 5 years on average. It will depend on the cycle you're on, but on average, it'll be about 5 years. And then it will require replacement, which is a further surgical procedure to replace the generator. But, you know, I think in future we might have externally chargeable devices.
Yes, technology moves on very fast, doesn't it? Yes.
It moves on very fast. Probably what we see most of is it can produce, because it's the nerve in the neck, which has branches towards the vocal cords, we can see hoarseness and cough during periods of stimulation. That tends to reduce over time. And sometimes you can see ear pain and face pain on that side. You do need to be careful with MRI scans after a device has gone in. And that's something the families have to be aware of. But you can do a brain MRI on a suitable scanner that's got a suitable coil. But the radiographers need to know that you've got a VNS in so that they can make sure that they have that suitable coil. And diathermy for surgery can cause some effects with the VNS, and therefore we recommend that the VNS is switched off for any surgical procedures that require diathermy.
Okay. That's lovely then. So we've looked at the surgery and we've looked at vagal nerve stimulation. So let's look at ketogenic diet therapy, last but no means least, as it can be as effective as medication. So why is it often considered as a last resort? Maybe not so much in your setting, but it often is considered the last resort. So is there any reason why you think it might be?
I think that there were perceptions, certainly from 1939 onwards, and I know that Professor Cross is giving a resume of 100 years of ketogenic diet, and there was a perception once the drugs came along that the diet perhaps, you know, could be left behind. And then what happens then is that fewer people are engaged in delivering the diet, so fewer people are experts, fewer people are trained. And interest and implementation gradually, I think, you know, weaned off a bit during that time. And I think there was also a perception, probably 80s, 90s, and the noughties, that it was a little bit unscientific and a bit on the margins, if you will, to think that changing a diet could have any effect on epilepsy. And why would you do that when you've got good scientific, meaning medication, treatments that had been shown in trials to work? And until 2008, there had not been any trials of the ketogenic diet. So it was easy, I think, to dismiss it and say, well, although lots of people are talking about this, there's never been a trial, has there? And then, of course, Liz Neal and Helen Cross from Great Ormond Street did do a randomised controlled trial, which was published in 2008 in Lancet Neurology, which did show once and for all that it does work.
Mm. And also it was in the drug resistant population as well. So that's the other thing. It wasn't just with any group of children with epilepsy. It was in drug resistant children, which again is that, what, 25-30% or so who have not already responded to medications. So, yes, yeah, so it's...
That's correct, but it's important to add then that by 2016, so you're talking about 8 years later, a Cochrane review did identify 7 randomised controlled trials by then. So I think that which showed a benefit, and the conclusion of the Cochrane report at that stage was that for those with medically intractable epilepsy or those not suitable for surgery, that ketogenic dietary therapy was a valid option. So I think since then, to be on a positive note, I think it's definitely gaining traction, much more so, particularly in the epilepsy community. And every regional paediatric complex epilepsy centre now in the UK has a ketogenic diet service, as far as I know, which means that everybody referring into those centres with children who have drug refractory epilepsy will now be knowing children who are being put on the diet and seeing that the diet is effective. So I think it's really growing in a positive direction now, and people at the regional centres, when they're asked to speak at networks and so on, present the data and the evidence. And so I think it's going to continue to move forward as an option in future, which is good. And I think alongside this, you know, the companies have developed products which have made administering the diet much easier for families. So the pre-packed powdered formulae for infants and peg-fed children, and other substitutes for eating or cooking, you know, the chocolate mousses and the fake breads and the keto porridge and so on. I mean, life is, you know, I know you know, Sue, you're a dietitian, but, you know, it really has transformed the ease of administration for families that there are these options. And also I'd like to, you know, really give a big nod to the charitable sector. in terms of improving the profile of the diet. So charities such as Matthew's Friends and the Daisy Garland Charity, who give away free cooking kits, free utensils. They have telephone helplines and they have masses of recipes for families now, backed up by the chefs that are working for the companies, means that the food options are not only much more plentiful, but, you know, having you know, of course, I compel myself to taste them all at the conferences. I can vouch for the fact that they are delicious. So I think it doesn't, you know, it doesn't come across as the sort of difficult to source, difficult to buy, difficult to cook, beige kind of diet that perhaps in the 80s it might have appeared.
And I think the availability of foods, the way that people eat nowadays, the lower carbohydrate, higher fat end, obviously that's not medical ketogenic therapy, but there's access to so many more products. I was just speaking to a gentleman the other moment who said that his children steal his snacks. He's on ketogenic diet and he bakes his snacks and his children steal them from him. So they can't, it can't be that bad, can it, if children are stealing their dad's ketogenic
absolutely
snacks?
Not. And actually it's got a bit of a profile now in sport, which I think is really making it mainstream in lots of ways, and less on the margin. So all of those things means that it's on
yes,
the up
the
and
profile,
up now.
You're right. I mean, I think the profile has improved, and that's, again, it's slightly different when we practice it within medical ketogenic therapies, but it's that whole idea of just being able to fit things in, and it can be fitted in within a family. And so that's really good. So would you like to tell us more about your experience with offering the ketogenic diet therapy proactively to patients with drug-resistant epilepsy or other to families?
Yeah, I mean, the experience I have at my centre now is that parents and carers are very interested in the diet as an option. We have a waiting list. And frequently when they come to the complex epilepsy clinic, so it's not even when they come to the ketogenic diet clinic, it's when they come to the complex epilepsy clinic, which is where I get to think through which of the options that I talked about earlier might be the most appropriate for them. When they come to that clinic, they've already heard of it and they've already read about it. So it's getting out there in the patient community as well. My experience is that they seem to enjoy the parents and carers seem to enjoy the increased participation that the ketogenic diet gives them in their child's treatment. And I think that's very important. And they frequently report improved alertness, improved mood, improved behaviour. And at times, they choose to stay on the dietary therapy for those benefits, and they're quite open about that and say, well, the seizures, it hasn't been miraculous effect on the seizures, this is for some families, but actually the other benefits are such that we want to carry on. So I think that's important, and quality of life's important for families who have children with drug resistant epilepsy, because it's very, very difficult indeed to manage a child who's continuing to have seizures and has some of the other difficulties associated with drug-resistant epilepsy, be it physical disability or learning disability. And so we published a paper in 2017 in Epilepsy and Behaviour about that, which had a more self-determined approach to quality of life in 12 consecutive families. And I think there are many validated tools looking at quality of life, but many of them are not applicable to this group. And you'll see when, I mean, some of the statements that we got from the families about benefit were, I want to, their aspirations for the diet were that they wanted to see their child smile, or they wanted their child to be more alert and be more happy. And rather heart-wrenchingly, on one occasion, I'd like my child to react when bloods are taken. So it's easy for us to project our views on quality of life and what should be attainable onto situations when, in fact, it's more important that we ascertain what is meaningful and what the aspirations are of that particular family. And my experience is that more than half the families in our service have had a meaningful benefit with the diet. And that my biggest problem is that after 2 years, trying to get them off.
Yes, and that is very difficult.
they want to stay on the diet often. And I suppose lastly, the last thing I'd probably say is that we do have families who don't experience benefit, potentially, because not everybody benefits from every treatment, actually. But it's very rare to hear that it's made things worse. That is quite rare to hear. And therefore, you know, that means that it's definitely worth giving it a go, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And the time interval as well. And we mentioned about the time interval with other treatments. So generally, you've got an idea as whether it's going to be working or not within about sort of, say, 3 to 4 months, would you normally say?
Yeah.
Yes, it's a relatively short space of time, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is.
And it just, if you're able to give it a go and a supported go, then it is worth a try. No, so that's really, really helpful. So I think we'll finish there. So thank you very much for joining me today, Anita.
You're very welcome. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And to those listening, we hope you've found the discussions of interest. Join me next time when Emma Williams, Chief Executive Officer of Matthew's Friends Clinics, draws on her experience of being a parent to a child with drug-resistant epilepsy. The thanks again also to Nutrisha Ketogenics for making this podcast series possible. And may I wish you all the very best, and thank you for listening.